content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. My name is Joe Austin, and I'm your host and producer for today's episode of Legal Matters, an original program produced in the North Carolina Radio Reading Service studio. For the next half hour, we will explore topics to champion your legal rights so that you can obtain equal access and full participation in our community and to achieve your goals of independent living. Every fourth Tuesday of each month, you can find us here providing news and information from federal and state agencies as well as nonprofit organizations that promote information and laws that support independent living. In today's episode, we will continue our exploration of Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and we are so fortunate to have Larkin Taylor Parker return to be our guest again. Thank you, Larkin.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
We're so glad to have you. And I thought we had a good program last week or last month about ADA Title III, and I'm not even sure we got halfway through with everything we wanted to do, so we've got you back to kind of pick up where we left off. Larkin, for our readers, reminder, is a lawyer with Disability Rights NC. Larkin, go back into, we may not have covered this, but when Disability Rights NC takes on a case, how much, how are the fees covered?
Well, we are fortunate to be funded primarily by federal grants, and we do not have a means test or charge our clients' fees in most instances. We may take a small contingency fee if we, so a fee that is paid to us if we win out of the winnings in the types of cases where our clients win money. What we charge in those cases is a bit below what I think the going market rate is, and we roll that right into helping the next person. In the bulk of our cases where there's no money involved and no money damages are possible, nobody is going to get paid if they win, we simply offer our services free of charge. So cost should never be a concern. If you think that you may need us, don't hesitate to call us. Whether we provide you with legal representation or advice or self-advocacy assistance, you can always give us a call, and we're not going to send you a bill.
Now, that is music to the ears of people with legal problems, so you can't beat that. Well, thank you very much, Larkin. Very good synopsis. So let's pick back up. We were talking last month about getting to the doctor's office and the basic right that you've got to get treatment at the doctor's office, just like somebody who is not impaired. So let's pick up with that. One issue I don't think we really covered was service animals and the doctor's office. Tell us about people's rights with the service animal.
Well, Joe, that's a timely, pressing issue. I'm glad you brought it up. We see a lot of issues with service animals in the doctor's office. And this is sometimes something that comes up in the context of people who are blind or have low vision. We've seen it with the mental health context, because service dogs are sometimes useful to people who have mental health disabilities. Service animals are generally going to be permitted in medical settings, as they're generally permitted in all sorts of places that people with disabilities may need to go or want to go. by a service animal, I mean an animal that meets the definition of a service animal under the ADA. So a dog, or in some circumstances, a miniature horse that is trained to perform specific work or tasks related to someone's disability. The rules are a little different for emotional support animals that provide comfort but don't necessarily have any special training. Those tend not to be as protected in public places. But people with service animals should be expected wide latitude to take their animals everywhere they go. There may be some limitations in medical settings, in situations where the person with a disability could not bring a human companion or aide or helper without that person taking special precautions like scrubbing in. So a service animal may not be permitted to accompany someone to the OR, for instance, but in the vast majority of medical settings, places where one could bring a friend for help or emotional support, bring a spouse to take notes, the service animal is going to be permitted. And if people are trying to predict and understand and advocate for themselves about where they should be allowed to bring their service animal, that really is the question to ask. Could I bring a human member of my support network without that person having to take special special sanitary precautions like scrubbing in or putting on a gown? And what that means, the implications of that, are that in typical doctor's visits, the law requires that service animals be permitted to accompany their handlers. There is no reason that a service animal shouldn't be able to go with its handler to, say, an annual physical or a doctor's appointment for a routine medical condition like a GP visit or an urgent care visit for the little illnesses that we all tend to pick up as it gets cold and people travel for the holidays.
And service animals, one thing that Disability Rights NC has white papers on the use of service animals on your website. So that's a good resource. How would our listeners access the papers you all have published?
Well, if you have an internet connection, our website is disabilityrightsnc.org, and you can find all of our materials there. We have certainly made an effort to get them into accessible format. If you don't have access to the internet, feel free to reach out to us, give us a call, and I'm sure we can get those materials to you in other ways.
Is that number 919-856-2195?
Yes, it is.
Okay, yeah. So our listeners need to have that have access to that telephone number, that very important telephone number. And I myself have represented a company that vis-a-vis Disability Rights NC, and I found that the lawyers on the other side were extremely collegial and willing to work things out. But and one of your points of emphasis is service animals. Isn't that right?
It is. We've done a lot of work on this issue because we want service animal handlers to have a seamless time moving through the world, moving through all the Title II and Title III, so the private business and the government. settings that they encounter in daily life. So we've written up those information sheets that you described. We worked with some law students at Campbell to create a video to help businesses understand their obligations. This is an issue that we really have tried to get out ahead of, and of course, we also have taken cases.
You've mentioned Title II of the ADA, and I want to get into that. Before we do, any other Title III rights that you can think of that we probably need to address on this program, especially as it relates to getting medical care? Or do you think with what we talked about last week and what we've talked about this week that we've pretty well covered that?
Well, one thing that I think listeners should be aware of is that sometimes in the disability community, and we all hope that this is rare and infrequent, we see issues arise where treatment providers may discriminate flagrantly and may have concerns about treating or working with or interacting with someone with disabilities beyond just barring a service animal or failing to provide effective communication. I'm talking about situations where people may be told that they are not worth treating. In a setting covered by Title III, things like communication access, things like service animal access, all of the accessibility failures that even well-intentioned people and institutions can make are covered. Flagrant discrimination, out and out, we don't want to deal with people with disabilities attitudes, hopefully much rarer, but they are out there sometimes, are covered as well. So keep in mind that both regrettably routine accessibility failures that are done by people with the best of intentions and more ill-intentioned discrimination can be tackled in this way in covered settings.
You know, that's a good point to segue, I think. It's de rigueur now for professional practices and as well as businesses to have websites. And so, normally a doctor's office has a website. That gets into Title II, doesn't it, the website accessibility?
Well, Title II is really about governmental programs and services.
Right. So the website access is still a Title III issue, isn't it?
Yes. It is when the owner of the website is a private entity as opposed to some kind of state or local government entity.
Right. And so, can you, the Title III issues and website accessibility has been in a state of flux, hasn't it, for several years? I mean, you go from one administration to the next presidentially, and, there's different rules. What is the status of rules that apply to websites? Has any government agency come up with a firm set of regulations that apply to websites?
No, and this issue is murky and in flux. There have been some very positive recent court decisions promoting web accessibility, especially the web accessibility of businesses. I suspect that the law in this area will move in the direction of requiring more and more accessibility of websites of Title III entities. And I really hope that is the case. There was a recent decision that really did promote this issue in the context of online ordering. But there are a lot of developments in this area of law still ongoing, and there's something of a circuit split. It is important that people with disabilities be given full access to the goods and services of a business, and at the very, very least, businesses that have a physical location linked to their website are more likely required to maintain an accessible website, and businesses need to afford equal access. The simplest blanket statement I can make about what is a complicated and changing area of law right now is that businesses have to afford people with disabilities equal access to their goods and services. So what would certainly be out of compliance is if a local restaurant, say, will only accept takeout orders through their website, not over the phone or in person. There's no alternative provided, and that website is inaccessible. At the end of the day, Title III places a lot of emphasis on equal access, and there needs to be a way for people with disabilities to utilize the goods and services just like anyone else. One metric that has been used for checking website compliance, and something that the Ninth Circuit found important recently, was WCAG compliance, and that's WCAG. And these are web accessibility standards that are kind of the gold standard these days, and for listeners who may be involved in making decisions for a business, this is a good thing to look into in terms of website accessibility. There are not hard standards for website accessibility written into something like regulations promulgated by the DOJ right now. And there are mixed opinions on whether that's a good thing or not. There are a lot of people who would like to see regulations, but it's also possible that any such regulations would have a hard time changing fast enough to keep up with technology. The idea was considered several years ago, and I haven't heard much about it in recent time. So these WCAG standards are really the best metric that we have for web accessibility, and courts that have ordered changes to websites for the purposes of ADA compliance have tended to lean on these. And I think it's also very common for consultants hiring themselves out to businesses to address web accessibility and make sure they get it right, to use these standards to ensure things like screen reader accessibility.
And everything our focus today was on medical treatment and getting access to doctor's offices. But everything that we have talked about applies to retail, doesn't it? And accessibility in malls and shopping in malls. A little bit of difference in application, but it's the same principles, right?
Oh, of course. all of the kinds of public places that people need to go to live in the world and enjoy their lives are, for the most part, Title III entities. All of these private spaces that people with disabilities go into every day and members of the public go into every day, and shopping is a classic example. Places like malls and grocery stores where we all may shop for holiday gifts or the foods that we want to prepare for the holidays aren't government-owned, so they aren't Title III. Those of us who aren't entering them as employees but customers aren't covered by Title I. Rather, they aren't covered by Titles I and II, but they're Title III entities. They're public places. And Title III, yes, very different application, different situations come up, different needs have to be met. But all of the Title III issues that come up in healthcare, ranging from issues with websites to inaccessible printed documents to service animal access to physical accessibility, will come up in the mall during people's holiday shopping as well.
Well, we have we've done a good job, I think, of covering Title III for our listeners. We got a minute or two. Tell us a little bit. Just give us a thumbnail sketch of Title II instead of Title III, and what Title II covers.
Well, Title II is a lot like Title III, except that it covers state and local governments. It does not cover the federal government, but state and local governments are prohibited from discriminating against people with disabilities and are obligated to provide things like access, provide reasonable accommodations to people with disabilities that want to use their services. And this can manifest in a lot of different ways, just like accessibility under Title III. Accessibility under Title II and what is required of state and local governments under Title II can look like everything that we discussed under Title III, except in a government-run, a public, as opposed to a private healthcare facility. It can look like a wheelchair ramp so that people can just get through the door at City Hall. It can look like closed captioning and ASL interpreters at city council meetings. It can also look like service animal access at important government offices, important government documents being provided to people in accessible formats, reasonable accommodations so that people can participate in various governmental programs. It's all of the sort of allowing equal access that we thought about under Title III, mm-hmm. just as applied to state and local government.
Let me interject a question there, Larkin. So everybody's got a 14th Amendment right to equal protection, and of course, disabled people have a statutory right to accommodation under the ADA. But what is the status of disability as a basis under equal protection? In other words, if I've got a disability, that puts me, I have a characteristic, which is, if race is a characteristic, sex is a characteristic, what scrutiny does disability get under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, or does it get anything additional?
Well, that is a question that hasn't come up too much in our work. I think that the reason the ADA is helpful is that it's really twofold. Different protected classes get different levels of protection under the 14th Amendment, and those levels of protection are based, and it doesn't sound very nice to say, but they are based on the sense that in some situations there may be valid reasons for treating some people differently.
Yeah.
So things like race receive a very high level of protection because there are not going to be many circumstances where there is a valid non-discriminatory reason for treating people differently on the basis of race. Gender has traditionally been perceived as somewhere in between, and there is a sense in the law surrounding this issue that sometimes it may just make sense to treat people with disabilities differently. So there is the possibility of some protection under the 14th Amendment, but the protections are so weak that what we tend to rely on is the ADA, the Rehabilitation Act, and our state disability rights statutes. The other reason, I think, is that sometimes there is a need for people with disabilities to be treated differently to have equal access. Handing someone who is blind and can't read print the same printed sheet as everyone else, for instance, is not... It is treating that person the same way as every other sighted person, every sighted person who receives that sheet, but it's not really treating that person equally and providing equal access. And the ADA is great in that it requires some affirmative steps to promote equal access, and the emphasis is less on treating people the same way, just avoiding negative, we don't want people like you in here discrimination, and actually promoting positive access and inclusion, which is, we definitely see from time to time real hatred directed at people with disabilities. But at least in my experience, the majority of the time, the problem is less someone saying, well, we don't want people with disabilities in here. We don't want to interact with someone like that.
And we hope you've enjoyed the show and discovered information about your legal rights. I'm Joe Austin, your host and producer for the North Carolina Reading Service. Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. After it's broadcast, you can find it as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. You can listen to it again and share it with others. If you have any comments or questions from today's episode or wish to suggest a topic to us that you want us to explore, please call us at 919-832-5138. We look forward to hearing from you, and we will be back next year. Anyway, thank you, Larkin.
Thank you.
Okay. That's a wrap, as they say. Well, Larkin, thanks so much.